All right, Mick, you're on.
All right.
Let's kick it off.
Okay. Well, and like I said, my expectation is that this is interactive, so break in with any questions that you have at any point in time. So the notion of private data objects sort of came out of two problems that we were working on in Intel Labs independently. One was obviously trying to figure out how to do privacy preserving, confidentiality preserving smart contracts using SGX and trusted execution. And the other one was a more general problem that we were working on with how to do kind of multi-party confidential computing on large databases. So this was work with the Broad Institute doing confidentiality preserving analysis of genomics. And these sort of came together in the sense that what we were realizing was that with the private data objects work, we were building something that gave us a way of binding policy to data in a way that we could ensure that those policies were enforced no matter who had the data. So it's not like I hand you a picture, and once I hand you the picture, you can make as many copies of it as you want. In this case, I hand you an object, and because we are trusting the TEE to enforce the execution of the policies to get at that object, then we can restrict the kinds of access that you have on it, even as that object moves around. So that's just sort of the high level preview of what we want to go through today. So this question that we started with when we were looking at the problem was, you know, what are the things that actually prevent kind of data sharing? One obviously is that we have restrictions on physical access, how we get access to the data. But really the ones that sort of that in this world of massive connectivity, really the problem that we run into a lot is risk of misuse and the desire to control and monetize the information that's there. That is, that if I give you something that represents business value, that represents personal information about me, there is a risk that you will misuse that information or use it in a way that's inconsistent with what my expectations are. And so I may have a set of policies, I may have a set of operations that I'm willing to allow you to perform on that data, but that's it. And up to this point, it's been very difficult to provide any kind of technological basis for enforcement of those policies on data as we move it around. So just the kind of example, the motivating example that we had for this, for the work that we started, geez, 3 years ago, 3-4 years ago now, was an automobile manufacturer that has heavily instrumented the car, all of the data about where the car is going, how fast it's going, all of its telemetry information is being captured. And you know, this car manufacturer wanted to figure out how they could monetize the data, which, okay, that brings up some interesting problems, which are sort of central to this, which is that the data is about a car that I own. So it's about me, but the car manufacturer is the one that's collecting the data. And this brings up this whole sort of complexity of ownership and access rights and other things that these policies are very complicated. So in this scenario, there's this changing sense of vehicle ownership. What the car manufacturer, the sort of usage model was, how do we provide right-sized information or insurance quotes for drivers? So with a changing sense of ownership, it's very difficult for a driver to accrue a particular driving profile. And so what tends to happen is, you know, if you go into Hertz and you say, I want to rent a car, and they say, do you want insurance? Well, the insurance that they're offering you is essentially at the highest risk level because they know nothing about you as a driver. So how do they get the information? How does a company like Hertz get the information? Or if I'm doing, you know, kind of ride sharing, usages or vehicle sharing usages, or if I have transient ownership of a vehicle, short-term leases for that. How do I establish my reputation as a driver that allows me to do this? So what we would really like to do is to have, and this was the sort of the car manufacturer's view of this was, well, look, you know, we can capture the identity of the driver, we can map the identity of the driver to all the telemetry data, and we get a very, very detailed representation of the driver profiles, right? This is not unlike the little dongles you stick in your car that you get from some of the insurance companies today that give you a discount if you're well behaved on it. The difference in some sense is that the dongle doesn't apply to a single vehicle. It has to go across all of the vehicles that you're doing. So we wanted to be able to do all of this. And of course, the underlying problem is that the detailed information that describes me as a driver also exposes an awful lot of information, ancillary information that I really don't want the insurance company to have access to. I want them to know that I'm a good driver. I don't want them to know that I stop at a particular Starbucks every morning for my coffee. So the question becomes, how do we personalize service? How do we provide an appropriate insurance quote for an individual driver, given all the information we could collect, but ensure that the only thing we're doing is evaluating the driver's appropriateness for safety purposes? So a bunch of questions come up on this, like, if we have this profile, where do we store it? Obviously, the car manufacturer said, well, you should store it with us. You know, that way we can monetize it. We can charge people for getting access to their profile. That doesn't really fly with most of the drivers that we talk to. So there's this question of who's responsible for the profile, who can access the profile. Why would the insurance company trust the profile? So I've put together this lovely profile out of the telemetry data that I'm collecting. I hand it to the insurance company. The insurance company says, gee, you've gone 72 years without a single accident. Imagine that. You must be a safe driver. Why should they believe that I've gone that period of safe driving? How do we ensure the integrity of the information? You know, sort of the reverse is that once I've given the profile to the insurance company, you know, other than sort of the legal aspects that come into play right now, how do I know that it's been deleted? But this brings up a whole bunch of other questions, right? You know, that are sort of, once we have this profile becomes a really valuable thing. It provides information both about me as a driver, but it also provides information about the roads that I'm driving on. It provides potentially information about the vehicles that I'm driving. So are there ways, once I've captured this profile, that I can use it not just for insurance quotes, which is what I was sort of originally intending it for, but for all of these other ancillary uses? And once I have this useful thing, you know, are there ways that I can monetize it? I don't necessarily mean monetize it in that I can charge a quarter for every time somebody accesses the profile. There may be additional benefits or additional rewards, but what I want to do is to find a way to capture the value of that profile. So there's a bunch of properties that obviously that the solutions have to consider. How do we ensure data integrity? What is provenance in this case? How do we guarantee appropriate use? And I say appropriate use because, you know, privacy and confidentiality are these sort of loaded terms and are restricted to a very particular domain. A much broader question is, what did I give you the right to do, and can I ensure that that's the only thing that you're allowed to do with it? That encompasses privacy, confidentiality, but it also encompasses scope, control, monetization as well. And then there's all these other questions of commensuration. You know, one of the things that has become a challenge with economies based on the exchange of data is that data is something that has no scarcity associated with it. That we can reproduce it as often as we need to. And as a result, building economies around data becomes very difficult. So when we do commensuration, the idea is that we can articulate a piece of or an object, and that object has some notion of uniqueness to it. It can't be sort of built upon and devalued by being copied that way. So that was basically the context in which we started working on these kind of smart contract problems, right? And so what we wanted to do. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you mind if I interrupt? I guess you said you didn't
mind. I don't mind in a bit.
So does the user have a link to this? So suppose I just want to like shut off my data and pay the higher rate. Can I do that?
Let me answer a slightly different question, which is if I have a piece of data that I've created, do I have the right to revoke access to that data?
Yes.
Right. There's a notion of revocation. So my answer to that is it depends on what the data allows. So what we're trying to do with the private data objects is to remove or relax the notions of ownership for it. So if I created a profile, and in the creation of that profile, I granted myself the right to revoke all access to that profile. Mm-hmm. Then I can invoke an operation on it, which will change the state of the profile, which will make any future access impossible to the profile. Right? Mm-hmm. And there are a variety of ways that we can enforce that kind of revocation or that kind of policy for removing access to the data in it. But let's say that data is something where you performed or I performed a computation using an analytics algorithm that you provided. And so the derived object is no longer wholly mine. It might be mine plus yours. So I may not have, even though it's sort of data about me, because of the way it was computed, I may no longer have the right to revoke access to it.
So I think the EU would probably disagree with you on that.
It's an implementation. It's a choice of policies. If this were the actions were taking place in the EU, then you simply write the policies into the contract that say, yes, I have the right to revoke it. And I have the right to revoke it for all derived objects. So the policies for access are not fixed. They're specific to a particular data element. So you get to choose what the policies are for it when the objects are created or when the contract is created to manage the object. So if you're operating in the EU and the EU says that you don't have the right to do that, okay, then write the policy so that I always have the right to do the revocation for it.
So I guess the related question would be.
Hang on a second, Ron. Do you understand where I'm going with that, Hart? That revocation is not a function of the infrastructure.
Sure.
Revocation is a function of the contract that is bound and the policies that are bound to the data.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, so if I wanted to have a more complicated policy where it says, I'm willing to give up ownership of derived data as long as it can no longer be identifiable to me, how would you go about addressing that policy?
So policies like that, you need to write code that can capture the properties over which you want to invoke the policy, right? So is there let me back up. One of the basic principles that we have for designing PDO is everything is opt-in. Mm-hmm. So as a user, I have a profile. You've asked that you want to perform a computation over that profile. So for example, you want to generate an insurance quote over my profile. I can look at the contract that is going to be invoked on my profile, that my profile is going to be handed to, and ensure that contract has a particular set of analytics associated with it. And I should be able to look at it and say, hey, it's got a revocation button, and then I'm going to be allowed to push the revocation button on it. And so I can opt into allowing my data to be captured inside the insurance quote, knowing that I have the right to revoke access to that quote at any point in the future. We've been able to do, and we've implemented a number of policies for things like data aging. So for example, no one has the right to look at or the set of queries over a particular data collection use a form of K-anonymous transformations, right? So it becomes essentially a heat map. And after a certain period of time, now the data itself becomes, now the raw data becomes accessible. So we can do policies like that that are associated with the data. With and the critical thing is that you don't have to have a continuous service operating because the policies are bound to the data.
Okay.
So, right. So normally I would do data aging by putting it someplace and then I would put some organization around it and say you either get access to it or you don't get access to it, or I put a service around it that enforced it. So but in this case, the data has the policy bound to it.
So the data has the policy bound to it, and then derived data could have more different policies, and that depends on some kind of inspection or certification of the code itself. Mm-hmm. You know, if it has, for instance, for the example I was thinking about, the right anonymity properties, then you can associate different properties policies with the derived data.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And just to, you know, to follow through on the example of the profiles and the insurance quotes, for us, the insurance quote, that is the rate quote that I get is just another object. It was created by applying a particular analytics algorithm to a particular driver profile. And the one that we've implemented, the rate quote, the insurance company only gets to see the results of that quote if I, as the driver, grant the insurance company privilege. So you perform the analytics, I get to interrogate the analytics, the results, and then I get to decide whether I'm just going to destroy it, throw that thing away, or whether I'm going to allow the insurance company to look at it and then give me the quote based on the contract.
I guess the other complicated is if the insurance company wants to keep its algorithm a secret sauce. Mm-hmm. Right. So in yep. that,
In order for that to happen, if you're so the basic idea that we have right now is that the code is the contract, right? And so the code represents the terms of our agreement and our collective agreement on how this data is going to be accessed and managed. And so if you can't see the code, you can't see that. Now there may be additional trust relationships that. Okay, you said that this object came from this analytics object came from you. There are flows that we can do that, but it requires that you trust the institution that created something rather than being able to look at the contract itself for it.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
So the core is the contract, the code is our contract. And so we're based on that assumption. That doesn't preclude us from other trust relationships. Any other questions? Okay, so let me go on and just sort of, we'll talk a little bit about the mechanics of this. And again, we can deep dive on whatever you would like to deep dive on. We don't have a lot of time today, so I wanted to sort of skim the surface at this point. The basic idea is that we encrypt the data. It's not enough then for being able to access the data. It's not enough to simply have the raw bytes. You have to have the keys in order to access the raw bytes. And the critical idea of the PDO is that the key is managed by the TEE, not by the person. That is, the owner, in a strict sense, the owner of all data objects is the trusted execution environment or the smart contract that's operating and executing within the trusted execution environment. That is, we give agency to the smart contract itself or to the object that is this combination of data and contract. So data is encrypted. The key is bound to a smart contract that's associated with that data. The smart contract formalizes these policies for access, update. I hate to say this, but for anybody who remembers CORBA, these are basically CORBA objects, right? I mean, in a philosophical sense, that there's an API for accessing them, there's some data that's hidden behind the API, and the only way to get at that data is through the well-defined, well-understood API. So the smart contract is the code, the data is the state of a CORBA object that's sitting on the back end of it that way. And that allows us to do these things that are much more interesting than open read and write. We can perform a K anonymity computation over something to generate a heat map, or we can do differentially private policies for different forms of data. Whatever it is that you can encode in the smart contract becomes part of the policies that are wrapped around the data. That smart contract then, in order to enforce the integrity of it, in order to limit access to the data through the smart contract, that is, to be clear, the only way that you can access the data is through the smart contract. The only way to execute the smart contract is in a previously provisioned trusted execution environment. And it's the TEE that secretly binds that key for decrypting the data to the smart contract and enforces that the only way, the only execution for it is in that high integrity environment. So that's basically how we do the binding of the code to the data. Then determining sort of what constitutes the authoritative copy of the data, and we use this for a lot of other things as well, but I'm just going to leave it at this for the moment. The blockchain becomes a root of trust. The blockchain is not where we perform the computations. The blockchain is not where we execute the smart contracts. The blockchain is simply where we commit to policy, for example, a provisioning policy or a replication policy that we'll talk about. So it's the meta policies for the object are committed there. We ensure integrity by capturing the notions of authoritative instances of the object. And then there's some additional work that allows us to do coordination so that we can do sort of old school transactions across multiple objects where we have sort of atomicity of updates concurrently across multiple objects. And it's that coordination that allows us to do things like fair exchange protocols, you know, guaranteed correct fair exchange protocols, and value transfers and other things that are part of that. So the blockchain, the role of the blockchain is the root of trust. Architecturally, there's some other reasons why we are separating the execution of the contracts from from the ledger. Go ahead.
Make question about the previous slide. So when you say the it's tied to the key in the trusted execution environment, does that mean every instance of the object is unique and not portable across TEEs?
Okay, so let's back up for just a second and talk about instances of the object. So using an object-oriented metaphor for this, a contract code is really a class definition. A private data object is an instance of that class definition that is bound to a chunk of data. So when I say private data object, I mean a single instance of data and code bound together.
Okay.
So just to make sure we're clear on that.
Okay.
For security purposes, a limited number of TEEs are provisioned with a key to decrypt the state. So the key is unique to the state of that object instance, not to the TEE. So And it must be explicitly provisioned to the TEEs. Now, this is one of our ways of ensuring security in the face of potential attacks on the trusted execution environment. That is, there are no universal keys.
Okay, so
there's no big target that if you attack this one piece would open up everything.
Okay, so let's say there are three replicas of the object. All three have the same key, and that key is somehow then bound to different TEs?
Yes, that's exactly it. So, and having replicas of the object, when we say replica of an object, what we really mean is I've taken the state and we have a way that the state, having the state gets you the code and gets you everything else. It's all packaged up, right? So I have the state and I can copy those bytes in multiple locations. This gives me availability, right? Or if it's a contract I care about, I just keep a copy of the state myself because I can then hand that into the TEE when I want to do the execution for it. But the keys, it's that in order for the TEE to execute, it must have the state plus some local information that the TEE has plus some global information. And it's that combination is the only way that we can reconstruct the key that's used to decrypt and encrypt the state. So it's unique to the TEE, to a set of TEEs. There's a MPC that's performed in order to provision that piece of it. And it's unique to the contract.
Okay, so there's a layer of infrastructure policies where you kind of authorize certain TEEs to decrypt the objects, if you will.
Exactly, right. And by the way, in the backup, there's a description of the provisioning protocol that we use for how to create those keys.
Got it, thanks.
So I explicitly, and this is where we do the sort of commitment. So this is kind of the philosophy of the user is in control and opts in. When you create one of these private data objects, you commit to a particular provisioning policy in the ledger that others can interrogate. So what that means is if I want to create my driver profile, I can say it's a driver profile. Here's the hash of the code that I'm going to use. Here is a list of the TEEs on which operations can be invoked and will be provisioned. And here's a set of the provisioning services that we're going to use in order to create that shared encryption key. So you can look at it and you can say, well, availability for this thing matters, so I want to make sure that a large number of TEEs have been provisioned for it. Or I can say confidentiality matters, so I want to make sure that the threat surface is as small as possible, so limit the number of TEEs. I can look at the provisioning services that were used to generate the keys, and I can say, oh, the keys were generated by 5 different provisioning services, each from a different CSP, each from a different organization. So it would be very difficult, given that the provisioning protocol that we have requires only a single honest participant, it would be difficult for anybody to game the system, right? So collusion is unlikely, so we're likely to have a well-provisioned encryption key, state encryption key for it. So all of that can be, all of that policy can be interrogated before I opt into participating in a contract. And all of that's committed on the ledger. So everyone understands and agrees that that's the policy.
Cool.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, so just sort of returning back to our transient, our driver profiles thing, there's a contract for the driver profile. So we have a notion of one of the operations binds the user to the vehicle. The vehicle is granted a key that allows them to update the driver profile with the information from the vehicle. The driver does not have the right to modify the profile. It is the driver's profile, but the driver does not have the right to modify it. They can register what amounts to an exception that what's in my profile is inaccurate, but they can't change it. And it's because they can't, it's precisely because they are not allowed to change their own data, that it gives the integrity that's necessary for the insurance company to be able to quote a particular rate for that driver with a commitment that goes along with that quote. So because the driver doesn't have the ability to change the contract and the TEE enforces that inability, then the insurance company can say, yes, this profile has integrity and is acceptable as the basis for quoting a particular rate to the driver. The rating contract allows us to create a quote object for the driver. The quote object is fed information. There's a secure channel between the profile and the quote object. Quote object generates a proposed rate for the driver. That the policy for it right now allows the driver to take a look at that rate. The insurance company, even though they provided the quote object, doesn't have the right to see any of the details of what's happening inside that quote object until the driver authorizes them to see it. So it's that sort of policy of having control over the flow of the information. So the driver has control over the flow of the information, even though they don't have all of the rights that I would normally have if the profile were sitting in a database that I owned for it that way. Okay, questions? All right. Okay, so all of that's lovely. Now we got to actually build the sucker. And there are a fair number of moving parts here, and there's one piece that's still missing, which is the replication. Oh, I do have the storage services on there. Sorry, this is the new version. So the different pieces of it, the ledger, as I mentioned, is really just a commit log. The contract provisioning services are responsible for executing the multi-party computation protocol that we've defined in order to provision keys into the contract enclaves. The contract enclaves are the ones that are actually performing the execution. So this is where the trusted execution environment comes into play. And then we really don't want the state being put on the ledger. It's expensive. It gets massively replicated. It can never be removed in theory. So we have a decentralized storage service that gives us some very interesting guarantees. The approach we've taken with the storage service, and again, this goes back to our basic philosophy, the client's in charge, right? If I care about the contract, it is my responsibility to make sure that I have a copy of the current state. That's the basic principle that we have. So what we provide is a Byzantine resilient notification service or availability service. So for storage, the idea is that we perform an operation on one of these private data objects. The state of the object is updated, and because the state is stored as a Merkle tree, we can do a really nice representation for a change set. So the change set then gets replicated out to each of the storage services. And when I commit the update transaction into the ledger for that object, I have to provide a proof that I have replicated. I, as the client, have to provide a proof that I've replicated the change set to the storage services. And that the storage services that I've replicated it to all agree that they're going to keep a copy of that change set for a certain period of time. So they're not required to keep it forever, but they are required to keep it for a certain period of time. And as long as they keep it for a certain period of time, I can commit the transaction to the ledger. Anybody else who cares about the state of that contract can now grab a copy from the storage services, squirrel it away, so that they'll have a copy available for them when they want to perform the next operation on it. The storage service, therefore, is not required to keep all copies of all state from all time. They can actually do garbage collection once the guarantees are for storage times are taken care of. As long as there's a relatively small number of we're back to the two-thirds, right? As long as there's 2F plus 1, or sorry, F legitimate storage services for 2F plus 1, or sorry, 2F plus 1 storage services with F compromised storage services, then we can actually guarantee availability over the time window that we've requested for it. We've been doing some experiments with how to do erasure coding in order to minimize that. There's actually do some really neat optimizations that are possible in there, none of which we've actually implemented, but have all been designed for it that way. So the storage service sits off on the side. It's fairly realistic in the sense that you can have whatever agreement as a client, you can have whatever agreement you want with the storage service if you created the contract. But at a minimum, it has to guarantee availability for a fixed period of time so that we don't rely on storage services capturing and providing availability to some chunk of data for decades if the object is going to last that long. questions? Wow.
Sounds okay. Like Live has a question on the chat.
Sorry, I can't see the chat because I'm full screen. So if you've got something, just ask it.
Okay, question from Clive. So Mick, seems obviously very comprehensive and well thought out, but it all depends on the TEE, the integrity of the TEE. If there was any sort of a way to compromise the TEE, is the fact that the objects are distributed and there's a collection of the objects that are required to reconstruct the key, does that deal with any unforeseen risk that maybe some sort of AI service may discover about any flaws in the TEE? It's almost like an academic question,
it's much more than an academic question. It's a very real question, and there is a very long talk. The talk that I usually give when I go to a blockchain conference is this, and I have to be a little bit careful how I say this. Let me just preface this for the recording that we have been working on this approach long before all the side channel information came out, because we perceived that it might be an issue, not because it was an issue to us. Okay, that's my legal cover my ass, excuse me, statement on it. But our basic principle is we design for compromise. Our security principle is that any one of the enclaves can be compromised, but that it's expensive to do. Right? So number one, for confidentiality, we explicitly provision keys for a particular object to a particular trusted execution environment, which means that even if an attacker is able to compromise an enclave, the only information that they can get at is things that have been explicitly provisioned to that enclave. There's no scalability in the attack. So if they wanted to get a particular contract, then they have to get a particular enclave in order to see it. So number one is limited vision, right? There are no big targets. There's no universal keys in here. We're going to make you earn it across every one of the TEEs if you're going to try to do a compromise attack that way. Two is that the protocol has been designed with the ability to do optimistic verification. So in Fabric, if I want to commit a transaction in Fabric, I have to have a set of peers that endorse a particular change set, right? And so the replication of the execution is required. So I can't commit until all of the peers or until enough of the peers have committed. In PDO, we have a notion of commit and revoke, commit on one, revoke on N. So one of the policies that you can associate with the contract is how many enclaves have to say that was the wrong answer before we agree that the computation was performed by a compromised enclave. So what that means is that I can commit on the say of an enclave, but every operation that is performed can be re-performed by any other provisioned trusted execution environment. So we can have a bunch of enclaves sitting off on the side verifying the transactions as they're committed. And if they see a problem, they can simply notify the ledger that there's a potential bad invocation, right? So it allows us to do optimistic execution and still have the same kind of integrity assurances that would go along with an endorser policy. The endorser policy requires pre-computation rather than post-validation on it. So we get a little bit of a performance gain. The other advantage of that approach is that you get to decide how important it is to you. So there may be, in Fabric right now, the endorser policy is associated with the chain code. We all agree that this is the policy for a commitment. In PDO, if if I don't trust a particular contract very much, I might verify every transaction. But if I kind of trust it, I may only verify one out of every 10 transactions, say. Or I may verify them in batches of 10 for it. But the verification policy is mine as a participant, and you may have a completely different verification policy for the same contract. So we have the ability to decide as a participant what our own risk tolerance is for it. So the third part of this is, again, because everything, all of the policies are committed to in the ledger and can be interrogated, you have the opportunity to decide whether or not, you know, you can opt into participation in the contract. You get to decide whether or not you're comfortable with a particular a contract. So if you see a provisioning policy for a contract and all of the provision enclaves are at the grad lab at Stanford, you might not want to do $1 million transactions on that. But if you see that the enclaves that are provisioned are across CSPs like IBM, Microsoft, and Google, where you know that you have the added benefit of physical security, CSP isolation on the computing resources, now you might trust the computation a little bit more. Right? And so you get to choose. What we're trying to do, the approach we're trying to do, is to provide you with the information so that you can decide whether the risk is acceptable to you for the computation. Now, there are a couple of things that make this really interesting, and these are the parts that are the research. Like, for example, my contract might be low value, and I'm okay with that. But if my low value contract gets co-located or co-provisioned into an enclave that has a high value contract, then that enclave becomes a more interesting target, and my contract might be more vulnerable for it. I mean, there are a bunch of those kind of things that are still how we share information about the overall risk of the provision enclaves. There's a little, and we're still trying to figure that one out. But for the moment, at least, we can say that one's been provisioned to a grad lab at Stanford. I don't know about that. That one's been provisioned exclusively to professionally managed data centers. Okay, I'm much more comfortable with it. Make sense?
That makes sense. Thank you.
Yep. So we start the design of PDO with the assumption that TEEs will be attacked and that attackers are really good. Okay. All right, so we don't have much time left, so I'm going to go through these pretty quickly, but there's an awful lot of detail in the backup that you can, you're welcome to look at, stare at, ask me questions about.
On the time check, is there enough so you want to continue again next week? Or
I'm happy to continue next week.
Okay. So
let me turn this around. Is this interesting enough to you that you would like me to continue with some of the details on how we do this next week? How's that?
Very much for myself. Let's hear the rest of the participants.
Yeah, I was actually hoping to hear mostly the details, but.
Okay, well then let me go through these principles. We can call it a day for today, and then we'll do the deep dive on some of the stuff that's in backup next week.
Sounds good.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
Heart. Okay.
Sounds perfect. I assume you mean 2 weeks and not next week.
But sorry, 2 weeks. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So just some of the basic principles that we've already talked a little bit about the security side of things, that our basic principle in security is we design for compromise. And I can't put that on a slide, but that's the basic principle that we've started with on the security. And it pervades pretty much everything that we do. We take a fairly conservative approach on what can be done by attackers, and so there's a number of things. There's a whole talk on how we do that, which is completely separate from this. So I've already said that this notion that the ledger is the root of trust. If you want to know what the current authoritative state of an object is, you go to the ledger, and the ledger is going to say this is the hash of the authoritative state, right? So it's the the root of the Merkle. It's the block, the root of the Merkle tree that represents the current representation for state. All transactions are state transactions, right? So it goes from an initial state with a method invocation applied to it, and it generates a new state. And what we're committing on the ledger is that transition, which allows us to serialize updates so we can do a sort of a proof of chaining of updates to a particular contract object that way. There are a number of things policy-wise that are established there that are expected to be enforced by the participants, although, again, honest participants will enforce it, and dishonest participants, its enforcement is optional. So although the protocols assume that a particular number of honest participants are executing the provisioning and replication policies, the binding of the contract ID to a particular instance of the code, and an initial state that's done. Now, one of the interesting things that this allows us to do, and this is one of the open research questions that we're working on, is can you do PDO and PDO? Right. So can I take the sort of commitment policies out of the ledger and actually implement them in a contract in a private data object so that I only have to manage the serialization of that private data object in the ledger, and all of the policies for what constitutes interdependencies between transactions and how to do provisioning and other things get captured in this external relationship.
So why isn't this possible with something like functional encryption, which like people have written about for SGX?
It is.
Okay. It seems like if you had a functional encryption system, then doing this would be straightforward.
Are you talking about the PDO, and about which part of it? The PDO.
Yep.
I think that is the case, that it's not sufficient, but it's one of the principles that we would like to be able to do. So the PDO and PDO is motivated more by some of the optimistic, pessimistic execution work that's being done. There's some of the consensus protocols at Cornell on this. Even if you look at the way Microsoft's decentralized identity system works, they're anchoring the truth of the DID in Ethereum, but all the transactions happen in their own service, right? And so you go through periods with the Microsoft DID where you have uncommitted changes that have occurred. But what that means is that you're taking the absolute slowest part of the system, which is the ledger, right? This is where the centralization and the consensus occurs. You're taking that out of as much of the computation as you can. So the advantage of this separation of execution and authority, by the way, you know, the short of it is that we learned from the Fabric guys that pulling ordering out of contract execution is a really good idea. We disagreed with the limited functionality. We think that just ordering is not enough. But separating ledgerness from smart contract execution means that you can do some really nice things with scale. And so the idea behind the PDO and PDO is we should be able to put one more layer in there that allows us to get even greater scale and less dependency on the particular issues of the ledger. That being said, the current implementation of PDO, this has not been pushed to Hyperledger Labs yet, is actually we replaced Sawtooth with Microsoft's CCF, you know, it used to be Coco, and we're now running thousands of transactions per second through the ledger, through their ledger, which is really quite nice. So this separation of execution and authority does some really nice things for scalability.
Are those figures public?
They are not public. We are in the process of cleaning up the code. To be honest, Hart, we actually ran out of client machines, so I don't know what the upper bound is right now.
Okay, because that would be useful to tell people.
Yeah. For both Coco's sake and CCF's sake and for the PDO concept.
Yeah.
But it's this notion, and it's part of the reason why Fabric gets a lot of its scale, is you can do arbitrarily complex chain code because you can scale out the number of servers that are doing the chain code. You're still bound a little bit by the endorsement policies and the serialization, but so are we, right? But the place where you want scalable execution for complex contracts, I can do analytics inside a contract, and I can afford to do complex analytics inside the contract because the rest of my ledger is not bogged down or dependent on that computation completing.
Sure. I mean, what Fabric is essentially doing with its endorsement policy is large-scale sharding.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's all there is to it. And if you assume, TE, then of course you get a lot of sharding for free as well. So
exactly. Right. And that's the basic idea that we have for it. So it's really a nice thing to keep these things separate. The other advantage is that your ledger can be sort of single purpose, single function. It can be hard coded rather than having to support dynamic code for it, which means it can be simple and it can go fast. And that's what we found with the CCF implementation of it.
Come on, Mick, you can always just code your ledger for the universal circuit.
Blah. Have fun. Are you volunteering to do that for us?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Just making sure. One of the other architectural principles we have is that the state is always encrypted and that the keys are associated with the contract, not with the creator of the contract, not with the person. And that means that we can create policies for doing kind of shared computation across data sets. Another one of our examples is we're taking a lot of those driver profiles, collecting them together and actually using them for doing traffic analysis. And so the only way, since there is no trusted third party to perform that computation, the contract becomes the trusted third party for it. And so this notion that the contract has agency gives us a lot of interesting things that we can do for computation. You'll see one of those at the demo at Hyperledger Global Forum with the Fabric Private Chain Code, where we're doing a spectrum auction, where the contract replaces the FCC as the auctioneer. In that case,
I was going to say, presumably you can do like the best sports betting network ever.
I'm not going to tell you what application I'm writing that I'm hoping will be done by the end of March when the NCAA basketball tournament starts. But I will send you an invitation to participate in it.
Sweet. Oh. Thank
okay.
you.
Uh-huh. This was actually a game that I learned from when I was working at IBM 30 years ago or 25 years ago and working with a bunch of the guys at Morgan Stanley that they used to do for the NCAA basketball pool. It's kind of fun. Okay, that's neither here nor there. Architectural principle, most motivated party is the one in charge. So the client is the one that wants to make sure the transaction gets completed. We can't necessarily trust the host of the enclave service to do the commitments. So the client is the one that's responsible for doing the commitments. There are some performance implications for this, and we do have ways of doing sort of optimistic execution, but at the end of the day, the one that's responsible to make sure that a particular transaction is committed to the ledger and that the protocol is implemented is the client, because the client is the one that wants it done. So that principle of driving replication, of driving transaction submission, of managing sort of the inter-contract communication channels, all go through the client because the client is the one that is most concerned about making sure that they're done correctly. Rather than doing direct object-to-object communication that's managed by the enclave service, where the enclave service could then perform denial of service attacks and a variety of other things. So we want the client in charge whenever possible. Let's see what else. Let's just leave it at that for now because we're out of time. So, Ram, I will send you a copy of these slides. I reserve the right to make a bunch of changes to them before next week, but we can go through the details on the backup next week if that makes
sense. Sounds good. Sounds good. Great presentation, Mick. Looking forward to the follow up in 2 weeks.
Okay. And feel free to send me email or chat on Rocket Chat if you have specific things you'd like to see, and if you have questions that you'd like to have answered next week. 2 weeks, sorry.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Mick.
Well, all right. Thank you all.
Bye.
Bye.